And indeed, you are tuned to 96.3 FM, Free Radio Santa Cruz. And for the next 2 hours, you'll be listening to Bathrobes Peel's Broadsides, a show concerning itself with civil rights for the poor, in the shelters, on the streets, and wherever you happen to be in Santa Cruz, in California, across the nation. My in-studio guest today will be Mayor Mike Rotkin. We'll also be having Dan Hopkins, who's a camper from the New Brighton Beach campground, previously from the Open Air Shelter in Santa Cruz, and Celine Pascal, who will be moderating with me in this special edition of Bathrobes Peel's Broadsides. We have our first live politician on the air here, and it's quite an occasion. Let's see if we got your mic working, Mike.
We'll test this here. This is Mike Rotkin, the mayor of Santa Cruz. Are we coming through? Sounds like we are.
I think we are coming through.
Good.
Mike, you initially wanted to make, you noticed this rally for Holiday Inn workers slated for Friday, December 29th, and you pointed out that that had been canceled and there have been some changes in that situation. Can you kind of give a brief update on that?
Yes, so I don't know how aware people are of this issue, but there's a gentleman, Solomon Saif, who owns a number of hotels and has his office, I guess, now in Foster City at a Holiday Inn up there, is contemplating buying the Holiday Inn from Charles Canfield, the Seaside Company that owns it right now. And there were rumors flying around that he was considering simply laying off all the existing workers and hiring people, new people, at a much lower wage and perhaps even without benefits. And as a result, the Hotel and Restaurant Workers Union went out gathering letters from public officials and individuals and gathered apparently 1,000 signatures from people in Santa Cruz on a petition saying that they would boycott the new hotel if the rumors were true. And at this point, Mr. Tsai decided to extend his escrow for another month into the end of January to further consider whether he really wants to purchase it, given what's going on in Santa Cruz and our pro-union penchant down here. But also, basically, both sides now are saying that they were willing to have conversations to talk about possibly working out some kind of a new contract and make things happen. Both sides are saying that they're trying to work something out. So I'm optimistic. I think it would not serve our town well to have to destroy the current union there and have the kind of boycott we've had there in the past. And so at this point, I'm hopeful that we'll have some discussions. And in any case, the rally that was scheduled for this this next Friday has actually been canceled because I think people are going to at least make another effort at trying to work this thing out before we reach that stage.
Let me ask you while you're here, I guess this is a question I hadn't really thought of, but the Canfield's Seaside Corporation, what's the unionization situation down there and what's the stance of the city toward that corporation?
Well, it's a non-union shop for at least most of the workers. There may be some union folks that work there, but the majority of workers are non-union. In the past, there was an attempt to organize on the part of the workers. This was actually when I was the mayor last time in 1985 and 86. And the city joined in a boycott while that union effort was going on. Eventually, the workers were defeated in that attempt, and the boycott was eventually called off. Just as, I think ineffective boycotts, this is my own personal view, that ineffective boycotts are not are difficult to sustain. You either have them well organized and you really kick some butt and people understand that you're bringing economic pressure against them, or it's the kind of moral attempt to sort of individually boycott. It's an individual decision people can make, but it doesn't necessarily work real well. So city eventually removed the boycott when the union itself backed off and the Central Labor Council removed their strike sanction. Mm-hmm. So that's, we don't win them all. That was one that we didn't win. And basically, Mr. Canfield generally has an anti-union position, and since it has an effect on so many jobs in Santa Cruz, I think it has an overall depressing effect on wages in the community. So I wish that were not his position. And we can't organize people for them. They have to organize themselves. And at this point, obviously, I would support any attempt of the people there to get unionized and to get the kind of rights and benefits that people get when they get organized.
How big is Canfield in Santa Cruz? I mean, what kind of economic power does he wield?
Well, there was a time in the past when the Seaside Company, not just Mr. Canfield, but the Seaside Company generally, was probably the biggest economic game in town. This is before the university came, or in the first several years after the university came in the late 60s, early 70s. I think that's not the case anymore. He still owns about half of the land. His corporation owns about half the land in the Beach Flats area. And obviously the boardwalk is a major employer in the summer months. So it's he's a significant player in Santa Cruz in terms of economic kinds of issues, but it's no longer a one-company town as it might have been in the past. There's a lot of other things going on that actually bring more money into the community than the Seaside Company. We are a tourist town, so it's certainly what happens at the beach is a big draw, and the Seaside Company itself, I think, and the boardwalk tends to draw people to town. So I'd say, you know, he's a very significant economic player, but no longer, you know, somebody who runs Santa Cruz, as perhaps was the case in the past.
Mm-hmm. I want to remind our guests, you're listening to Free Radio Santa Cruz, 96.3 FM, and I was chided by a friend who told me that I was not announcing the on-air number enough. So here it is. It's 427-3772. This is a call-in show. Our show is for you to call in to talk to us and let us know what you think. That's almost more important than what we're saying, because I'm here every week. Mike has a forum at the City Council. You can hear us when you wish, but we can't hear you unless you call in to tell us what you have to say. If you have questions for me or for Mike on any subject we've been discussing or other subjects, do give a call to 427-FRSC, 427-3772. Our lines are currently open. So, kind of concluding on this Holiday Inn situation here, do you think that there's a likelihood of a repeat of 1986 in terms of you as a city council member seeking a boycott, or to support a boycott, or to support a strike, or I mean, what do you see as in the cards, or as, at least in terms of possibilities for people to consider?
I guess I'm not really great at making predictions about where the future is going to go. I you know, tend to be an optimistic person by nature, and so my hope is that this will work out, and we won't be forced to that kind of a boycott. I think the people of the city of Santa Cruz, both union members, activists, you know, within the Central Labor Council, and just the general community, tend to support labor boycotts in town. And if one is, you know, forced into place, I think it'll definitely be an effective one. But my hope is that this can be worked out. It doesn't serve any of us to have long boycotts. The first thing people see, tourists see when they drive into town along Ocean Street, with, you know, being a bunch of pickets out in front of the largest hotel in that area. So my hope is it doesn't come to it. And I can't predict. You know, we'll see where it goes. At this point, both sides are saying they're willing to talk, and that's a good start.
When you were elected mayor in 1986, I believe it was either a 4-3 or a 5-2, I guess it was a 4-3 majority that the progressives had. There was Marty Wormhout, John Laird, you, and Bruce Van Allen on the council.
Actually, at that point, it was Jane Mead had replaced Bruce Van Allen by 85.
Ah, yes, thank you.
In the 83 election, Bruce was replaced by Jane.
That was a significant election, I remember, because I think as a consequence of a court decision in that election, Attorney Ray Grunach tried to get homeless voters the right to vote by registering at their great, so to speak, or wherever they work. Santa Cruz doesn't have greats, of course, but their park bench, wherever they happen to be lodging sort of en route as they were being shuffled around into the camping van. And he failed, although the voters up at UCSC, who conservatives challenged because they'd voted for Jane Weed, and there'd been some question about their residency, were allowed to vote. And then a year later, or 2 years later in Santa Barbara, we were able to secure the vote for homeless people at arbitrary addresses. Essentially, you just needed an address, and then you could state where you were. You need an address to send mail, and then you could state where you happened to be, whether it was a tree or whatever the heck it happened to be.
I mean, the UCSC issue got complicated because people were registering not where they lived, namely their dorm room, but at their mailbox at the campus, and the decision was that that was inappropriate. Several of the people who were registering at the mailbox actually lived in apartments downtown or in other parts of the community, and the court actually decided that the people who really lived on the campus and had mailboxes there, that was okay, that those folks were legal votes, but the ones who had been registering at a mailbox on campus and you know, subsequently had moved somewhere downtown since they left the dorms, those votes were discounted. And as a result, the election was brought much closer, but Jane Weed still won the election. It didn't affect the outcome in the final count.
Yeah, those were kind of heady days for homeless activists, both nationally and locally. You were, of course, involved in the controversy around the opening of the first Cold and Rainy Night shelter, the Cedar Street shelter and Peter Kuroda's shelter, which happened as a function, in my reading of history, because of the hunger strike of Jane Immler after 6 months of organizing protests before the County Board of Supervisors and urging action by the City-County Task Force. Do you have any recollections of that period that you wish to share with us that perhaps diverge from mine or support mine?
Well, I think there's a series of events that are all what sociologists would call overdetermined, lots of different things played into the final outcome. I think Jane Elmer's hunger strike was definitely an influence on Parley and Paige Smith, who subsequently formed the Citizens Committee for the Homeless, or CCH, and they opened up the first, wasn't the first, Peter Croyd had already opened another, but opened one of the early shelters in downtown Santa Cruz on Cedar Street, I think again largely affected or influenced by the hunger strike that Jane was involved in. At the same time, the city itself was beginning to try and figure out what, you know, what can we do more in the way of providing health services and other services for homeless people. So I think there was a convergence of a couple of different efforts. So I think it's always a mistake in history to sort of attribute what happens to one person or one thing, but certainly Jane Elmer's hunger strike played a key role in influencing the Citizens Committee's formation, the first shelter. As a result of the Citizens Committee opening that first shelter on Cedar Street, the city began looking for some other kind of a site that might be successful as a more permanent location for shelter services. And that's through that process, as I was mayor, working with some of the local business leaders, some of the social service activists and others to locate the corner of River Street and Highway 1, where a number of homeless services exist today, the day shelter or Santa Cruz Community Resource Center, Homeless Resource Center, County Mental Health Program, the River Street Shelter, the temporary open-air campground, which I'm sure we'll be talking about some more, and so forth. And so I think, you know, Jane did play a role in it, but you know, it would be a mistake to say she did it all or something, and she, of course, never would have claimed that for herself. She just played, you know, she took an act, and I think it made a difference.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I again want to encourage our listeners, if you have any thoughts on what Mike is saying or what I'm saying, you're listening to Mayor Mike Rotkin and me, Bathrop Spear Robert, here on the Bathrop Spears Broadsides, give a call to 427-3772. We can use some input from some outcasts or possibly just some ordinary folks downtown who have access to telephones. So you can give us a call, 427-3772. And we're kind of starting on a low key here, trying to perhaps work into the more controversial aspects of what we're going to be talking about. Mike and I have had severe disagreements in the past and attacked each other savagely in different letters through City on a Hill. And Mike has even seen fit on occasion to threaten me with arrest, and I've denounced that. And I think we're going to get into some of the issues behind this, that the personalities really aren't that important. It's the principles and the concerns that both of us have, or at least I don't want to speak for Mike. It's the concerns that I have in this situation and that I would like to see him and the city council have that I'm going to try to bring up to him. Maybe we should just go for the bullseye right now, and then, you know, we can kind of elaborate on it or dance around it or give the history of it and go into subsidiary issues. Or I have a tape which I'm going to be playing soon, which essentially is a tape of an address you made to the campers at the open-air shelter on Saturday, December, I think it was the 16th. And you came out to the field with Scott Kennedy, Councilmember Byers, Daryl Darling, head of the Community House, what I call the Trailers Not Trolls Project. There's been some dispute, $850,000 to $1.3 million project for 48 people that will supplant the open-air shelter unless another space is found for it on the property where currently the open-air shelter, which is has been in essence a campground for mandated originally for 75, but it grew to 150, 200, even at one point we counted 250 people. Dan here can give us estimates. Dan Hopkins is a camper. He used to count tents every morning and count bodies every night, and he was kind of trying to do a pretty close watch on what went on there. You came out to the field, to the back 40, the open air Coral Street open air shelter, as it's called, 5 days after Paul Marceau, who is the head of that open air shelter, an employee of the Citizens Committee for the Homeless, which runs the shelter, 5 days after Paul had announced it was closed, in blatant violation of an agreement made between the Citizens Committee for the Homeless and SOS, Save Our Shelter, which was the group representing the campers. And I'm also going to play a verbatim copy of that agreement, spoken either by Daryl Darling or Paul Marceau. It's actually repeated several times.
I wonder if you play part of the tape where the homeless campers go after you for driving me off the field. And
no, I don't have that on tape.
Oh, you don't have that on tape.
You should have brought your tape recorder.
An interesting part of the conversation, I thought. And they made clear that they basically didn't share your view about what their goals were, and they basically said you weren't speaking for them. So it's unfortunate that the same tape.
You've got to bring your own tape.
I've got to bring my own tape. I'll try and think of that in the future.
Really, it's always very useful to have a tape recorder. And in fact, frankly,
that is an accurate representation.
There was a strong
not all, but the majority of the
there was an angry reaction by at least several. I don't know if I would say a majority. Certainly a majority agreed with the plea. Maybe I should go. We should kind of backtrack.
Yeah, because people don't know what we're talking about.
Yeah, Mike was presumably called in to explain to campers what there was a great anxiety because Paul Meursault had announced, as I said, in violation of the agreement that had been made, solemnly made, between the campers and the Citizens Committee for the Homeless, that there would be renegotiation if there were any weather problems. And no such renegotiation occurred. And if, in the absence of such renegotiation, people were supposed to be able to be there until January 1st with a 10-day notice, or later, depending on when the so-called community house permit was granted, because community house was the trailer project, the million-dollar trailer project. It was supposed to supplant the open-air shelter and was, in essence, the excuse for closing the property, although it must be said fairly that in the past, the property has always been closed in the winter because of weather conditions and because of lack of staff and funding. This winter was to be an exception, at least in terms of the arrangement made between the campers and the Citizens Committee for the Homeless. They broke their word. Campers were very anxious. There had been a drug overdose that I believe, some campers believe, is related to the anxiety and concern. Some campers have even called Paul Meursault and Daryl Darling murderers, by the way, around this issue, because we don't know if this woman is going to live or not. She's last I heard, she was in intensive care. Do you know what the story is with Jennifer, Dan?
Yes, today is for
the... Can't hear you unless you come in here on the mic, but... anyway, we go ahead.
As a matter of fact, this morning, just a few minutes ago before I got here, I talked to her boyfriend, and he said that she's still not awake, but they said that she's responding well to the medicine or whatever they're doing for her. And they're talking about taking her to some sort of a convalescent home because they don't know yet if she has brain damage or not. And that's what I know so far.
Well, I mean, my point...
Maybe before we get too far into it, let me just respond to that one little piece of the action. I think it's reprehensible to blame the Citizens Committee or the city or anybody else. A woman is a heroin addict, apparently, if again, I may have the total story, but injected saline solution rather than water in the mix of whatever she was doing, notice made some mistake, and to sort of blame that on the anxiety that was caused by people seems completely out of line. People OD every day that use heroin. It's a dangerous thing for people to be doing, and to sort of blame that on the city or the Citizens Committee seems a little reaching, is I guess the word I would use.
I actually didn't concoct that charge myself, Mike. I was quoting several campers who felt, in fact, some of the leading spokespeople among the campers who really felt that the anxiety created had produced a situation where people are more likely to go shoot up than not. But you're right, heroin addiction is heroin addiction. I don't know whether it was heroin or something else, but I heard amphetamine at first. But what I then heard from Scott Kennedy, I found equally despicable. His response was that he felt, Dan here actually had a confrontation with Scott, which I happen to have on tape, in which he said, how can you sleep at night? And Scott rejected this as some sort of moral guilt tripping and said, I wonder how you can sleep at night, or I have problems sleeping at night thinking that the campground is open and maybe that this drug overdose is a function of the campground being there, when in fact, the presence of the campground, the presence of people nearby in a community situation allowed this woman to live. She'd be dead today if this happened under the bridge.
Yeah, see, these hypotheticals are rubber. You have to say, you know, here's a person who perhaps if there had not been an outdoor open campground would have felt that she had to go into the indoor shelter. Maybe she wouldn't have been, you know, it's the what ifs. If pigs had wings, they could fly. Here's a woman who maybe wouldn't have made her connection, wouldn't have tried to shoot the stuff up. Who knows what would have happened? And so, I mean, I think it's an unfortunate circumstance that she had, it wasn't an overdose, but this response to whatever she had injecting to herself, and
I think
to sort of blame that on people, say that you know the cause of what made that happen.
I don't know the cause, Mike, but I do know that people in a community situation. I know the cause that she lived, in my opinion, was because somebody ran for help and there was an emergency service there. If this had happened under a bridge, I don't think those kind of services would have been available. If this had happened in the Poganip, where people are, many of those campers have gone, and I don't mean the 47 that got the luxury busing down to New Brighton Beach. I mean the other 150 people, some of whom went into the armory and some of whom are able to use a church program, but many of whom are off in the bushes and under the bridges and, you know, wherever the heck they can hide, away from the police department and the camping ban, they have, I consider, a much more perilous situation than they had before. And I don't think that any reasonable person can deny that.
Well, watch a reasonable person.
Go for it, Mike.
Deny that. I mean, basically, let's go to a more fundamental level and start the conversation maybe there and get into it, which is,
sure.
You can respond, obviously. I don't think the city of Santa Cruz or any community is in a position that it can provide open-ended, endless services for people who basically are not willing to find some way to support themselves. I don't have any illusions that the system makes that easy for people to do. I think people that don't find a way to make a living deserve civil liberties and civil rights. It's not a question of repressing their ability to exist in the community.
What about the downtown ordinances, Mike?
Which I'll be happy to talk about. But the having civil liberties and civil rights doesn't allow you to behave in a way that's oppressing other people. It certainly doesn't guarantee you certain kinds of services from any particular community. And so the city of Santa Cruz, and I'll make this, a one-minute statement and go from there, is the city of Santa Cruz provides more social services for homeless people than any per capita, than any city in the United States. I've checked that against Berkeley, Santa Monica, San Francisco, Los Angeles, New York, and Washington, D.C., and Fresno. Now, maybe there's some community somewhere that I haven't heard of, but those are reasonable places to look for people who might be spending more than us. And no one is spending more than the city of Santa Cruz on these services. But we don't provide every service for people. We don't guarantee everybody has a place to sleep in the kinds of conditions they want to, or that they have a right to sleep outdoors, or that they have a right to a particular kind of food or health services or whatever. We provide some health services, some food services, some shelter services, the best services that people can get anywhere in the country. And the homeless themselves will tell you they come here because this is the place where they get the best treatment anywhere else. It's taken us years to develop those services, to build the public support for them. And my sense is that people who are demanding more are basically undermining the public will to even provide that level of services. So that's the situation that I think we're in Santa Cruz. And to say that we don't provide every service to people is an unfair charge against the people of the city of Santa Cruz or the city council.
That was good. 65 seconds. I commend you, Mike. If I could do as well at oral communications, perhaps I wouldn't be interrupted. Responding to a couple of your points, I don't think people are looking for open-ended services, and I don't think they're looking for a lot of expensive services. The open-air shelter was very cost-effective. It was very, very cheap considering the number of people that were served. We're also talking about the fact that Well, let me go through a couple of points you made. It's a kind of homeless services, I think, that we're concerned about, too. And does the money that Santa Cruz may indeed spend more per capita than any place in the country, but on what? When we actually have a campground, which was one of the original demands of that hunger strike back in 1985, the Gene Immler did, that we talked about, so because that would serve the most homeless people, the city council and the county ignored it and just didn't deal with it, and gave it the runaround. And we've been getting the runaround for a legal place for people to sleep for years. City council dismissed the idea in 1990. Finally, it snuck in through the back door, I think primarily because people slept outside on that property illegally anyway, and it was becoming more and more difficult and also cost ineffective to go after these people. So Karen Gillette and Michael Dunbow did a deal. Citizens Committee for the Homeless said okay, because they purchased the property and they couldn't build their community house. They were futzing around looking for funds, and still are, I might add, to the best of my knowledge. So we have a campground that was working. It was working. And now there's all this talk about a health hazard, which I'd like to go into as well. I've heard no reports of a health hazard. But before we go into the new stuff, I want to again refer to what you've said.
There's your minute.
Okay. In the last 5 seconds.
Take another minute. I just want to say it shouldn't
be. I wanted to be fair with you here. You claim the homeless come here because we provide the best services. I have never heard people say that to me, and I wonder if you have.
I've had homeless people over and over again, virtually every time the city council hears from the homeless, a certain percentage, about 30% of the people that get up, say they might like more services, they don't like the way we're providing things, they've got an objection about a particular issue, but they think Santa Cruz is a wonderful place, and they've come here because this is the place where they're treated the best. And I hear this from the homeless themselves directly all the time.
Really?
Yeah, so Robert's up here, so I get another 5 seconds. I really think that the issue here is not that the city of Santa Cruz doesn't provide people with some reasonable place, alternatives for people to go, but there are certain people who clearly make a decision that they don't want to be indoors, that they want to camp outdoors or whatever. The city of Santa Cruz is not in a position to provide those kinds of services. And there's no question that when you do, I think if you provide people with reasonable services, that's the minimum that a community can be doing. I hear the argument somehow that if you provide any service, and I've been hearing this a lot in the last couple of days, that if the city provides any services, it will attract people to your community, and therefore a city shouldn't provide any services for the homeless. And I reject that. I've rejected it and fought about it publicly for years. and played a key role with others in persuading the people in this community that we should be providing some basic services for folks. But I think when you provide outdoor camping for people, that it in fact does attract people to a community. And the cities that have had outdoor campgrounds that I understand, Portland, Eugene, San Diego, and Berkeley, at least the ones I've looked at, have all closed their outdoor campgrounds down, every one of those cities. Because what happens is, as Robert pointed out earlier, you start off with 70, and then you have 100, and then you have 150, then 200, and there's no end. And as recently as yesterday, people are coming to the mayor's office to ask, because they heard about this big controversy which got some press, where's this free campground? They come down here from Oregon, where's the free campground in Santa Cruz that they're supposed to be able to go to?
How many people came to your
house? Three people came to city.
From Oregon?
Yeah, and that's just, you know, a small tip of the iceberg, I'm sure. And I'm persuaded that if you provide certain kinds of services, that it will in fact draw people from other places to your community. It's common sense. It doesn't require a sociology degree to understand that if you provide open air campgrounds.
They said they came from Oregon to find the free campground, or they happened to be from Oregon and they heard there was
a free campground in Santa Cruz, and they wanted to know where this was, and they were ready, you know, where.
They heard it in Oregon, or they heard it in Santa Cruz?
No, they heard it in Oregon. They had come that day. They had just arrived. They'd hitchhiked down here. They had just hitched down.
So the Oregon news media reported that there was a free campground in Santa Cruz.
Correct.
Wow,
and what I think they were looking for was the state park campground, that somehow that was now open to the public generally to come down there and camp for free, and the city was going to pay for a free ride, which was of course not the case. We provided limited stay for only until January 1st for 42 to 47 people who actually had been in the open air shelter before. Anyway, so I think this, I mean, I may be wrong, and maybe I'm unfair to folks, but my view is that an open air campground in fact attracts people from other communities to the small city of Santa Cruz with 50,000 people cannot provide, for the 10 million homeless people in America. You and I agree on one thing. America's got a major homeless crisis. It's we figure maybe 10 million or something close to it in the country. And what we disagree about is what level of service or what kinds of services should Santa Cruz provide that don't bring all of those 10 million people to our town?
Well, I definitely don't know the answer as to how attractive the open-air shelter at Coral Street is. I've never heard of anybody being attracted by the Coral Street open-air shelter. On the other hand, the mayor's providing bus treatment and free lodging in a state park for 2 weeks in a beautiful campground is indeed something else. I might travel from Oregon for that, but that is a completely different situation, and frankly, I think a rather disingenuous solution, and no solution actually, to an embarrassing problem for your, and I'm going to say this, I assume are your friends on the Citizens Committee for the Homeless. Amen. We hope you're not with the FCC.
Oh, no, I left the
CDC. Let somebody get in the studio here, but we're okay. This is Free Radio Santa Cruz. You're listening to 96.3 FM. And the call number is 427-3772. We've been deluged with phone calls, so try a phone call so we don't both feel like...
We can promise you that if you call, you'll probably be heard.
You will be heard, yes. The solution of busing people off to a let's say a much, much nicer place than they were at before for a very limited number of them, in order to get rid of a problem that the Citizens Committee for the Homeless wants. The campers didn't even ask for this. The campers simply asked that they be allowed to not even fulfill the original terms of the deal made with the Citizens Committee, that they be allowed to stay till January 1st with a 10-day notice. Rather, they be allowed to stay until January 1st, 2nd, or 3rd at the open-air shelter. But I suspect, and correct me if I'm wrong, Mike, that Paul Meursault and the Citizens Committee for the Homeless did not want to deal with the problem of protest on their site. So what they did was they had these campers essentially under the gun. And you put them under the gun, too, with what you said, and I'm going to play your speech to them, in essence saying the cops are going to come in, they're going to break up this campground, you can decide if you want to go to jail or off into the bushes or into the armory, that's what you got to decide. Make your own way, we got no free lunch here. That sort of thing is what you were saying.
It wasn't quite like I didn't use the phrase "no free lunch."
No, you didn't. So. You didn't use the phrase "no free lunch," but you're talking about free services, and you're using the kind of rhetoric that I find uncomfortable. But more important than that, this whole I don't want to lose my train of thought, and I don't want to give you a chance to intervene before I've quite made my point. But I'm going to give you a chance, Mike.
Go ahead.
It seems to me that the original deal was violated. The Citizens Committee faced protests. So what they did was they got together with you, or whoever kicked down the money. I'd like to kind of, I'm kind of curious as to who did kick down the money for this whole plan. And instead of putting it into a real, into a continuation and improvement of the services, sawdusting over the area, putting in some planks so that those could continue in that field without, without health problems, and they could have, and they can. And I think that's, that is the case, until there is a real flood situation. And even then, we're talking about moving to higher ground. There was discussion of weatherizing it. Many had weatherized their tents and so forth. Instead of that, in order to spare the city and the county, I'm sorry, spare the city and the citizens committee, the spectacle of protest on January 1st, 2nd, or 3rd, and the real wrenching reality that people are being told, get out, get illegal, get out, or shoot your dog, you know, or get rid of your dog, because many of these people have pets and dogs. You know, you came up with this fancy, flashy solution of sending people out to New Brighton Beach, which I think is nice for them. I'm glad they have that solution. But they had no choice. They were not in a in a position to negotiate. They were under the gun.
Okay.
Go ahead.
Fine. Sure. I mean, the situation was partially as you represent and partially not. I don't know about what agreements were or were not reached between the Citizens Committee and Save Our Shelter. I wasn't involved in it. I understand some city officials, Catherine Byers and Scott Kennedy and Celia Scott, were involved in it. That both Catherine and Celia felt positive towards the idea of having a continuation until January 1st, as an, and their position was not that there would be an ongoing open-air campground, but until January 1st, and taking the position that the campers would have found that, you know, an adequate time to be there. They don't remember the agreement the way you apparently do, which is it was going to be until January 1st, or for 10 more days, or forever, until the campground opened or something, but until January 1st was their understanding. Scott Kennedy never agreed to that. Consistently at every meeting that he went to made clear that he didn't support that, that he felt that there should not be a winter campground in Santa Cruz. The city's position is we have never approved an outdoor winter campground. We've never even approved a permit for tents on the site. We approved a temporary emergency summer shelter because that's when the indoor shelters closed in Santa Cruz. The last time the place had a permit was October 1st, 1994. And basically, people just looked the other way as this winter, when the National Guard Army opened up late, people left the campground open until National Guard Army opened up. When it finally did, people stayed. The city, it's not just the Citizens Committee that has the ability to extend an agreement. It requires the city to permit it, because we don't allow outdoor camping without permits in the city of Santa Cruz, so as you well know. And basically, we decided, along with the Citizens Committee, we got a letter from the Citizens Committee saying, you know, we're the property owners, we'd like this place closed down. We got the letter, we agreed that we would close it down. We wanted to give people some reasonable time to transition out. We didn't sort of say, you know, you're under arrest, we're going to beat you all over the head or something. We told them on Tuesday at 10 o'clock in the morning that they had probably till the following weekend to get their stuff together, to move out, to face the same situation that they face anywhere else in the country and anywhere else in this city in past years. And that's what was worked out on Saturday. I came to tell people that. If you play the tape, they'll hear that, that I was saying basically, this place is closed, I'm not here to negotiate that. The place, in my view, and we may disagree about this, was unsafe for people to be. There was raw sewage running across it from a leaking porta potty, and the place was underwater. The fact that people might be able to winterize it is not the issue here. It's not like they have a legal right to stay there. The property owner, the Citizens Committee, said get off the property. The city was prepared to enforce that, and you know, we had never promised people a winter outdoor shelter, and the idea that you could leverage the generous summer shelter into a winter shelter doesn't mean that it was ever approved or that anybody ever agreed there would be such a shelter, including the Citizens Committee agreement, if it was as represented by you, which was only until January 1st. The last 30 seconds here, the campers themselves, when I met with them on Saturday, said, all we want is two more weeks. When you and a number of advocates, non-homeless advocates for the homeless folks, said that they felt the shelter shouldn't be closed at all, and that, you know, it should stay open, and that January 1st was an artificial deadline, and other points to that effect. The camper said to you, in effect, and literally, shut up, you don't represent us, we'd be thrilled to have till January 1st, and you said, you know, they shouldn't settle for so little, they should make bigger demands, they were being, I mean, you know, I'm going to put words in your mouth, but basically that they shouldn't accept such a pathetic deal, they should fight to keep the place open. And we, at that point, we left the place. I left and went down to New Brighton State Beach because people said there was a rumor that the city was going to place people there, which was in fact not true, but that sparked an idea. I drove down with Scott Kennedy. We found that people could camp at New Brighton State Beach. So we tried to respond to what the campers themselves were asking for, which was to be able to stay until January 1st, get their checks, get their cars fixed, or whatever it was. You know, each of them had different kinds of issues. And so we tried to do what was humanitarian, respond to their needs, but not to keep the campground going. There has never been a plan to keep the campground going all winter. You would like it to be the case, but no one has ever agreed to create a winter ongoing campground in Santa Cruz.
Actually, yeah, there are a lot of things in what you say that I think are quite inaccurate and disingenuous that I want to respond to. Some things that are true, of course. And we have an incoming call, and I'm missing my chance to respond. Caller, keep calling, keep the phone. I'm going to make a very quick response. It's true the city, as permit, I presume, has expired in October of 1994, but the city has taken no action to close the campground prior to now. It need not close the campground now. That apparently was an arbitrary choice made by you and others to support a Welch deal by the Citizens Committee for the Homeless. And I'm going to play the tape that shows you that it was a Welch deal, and it's not simply my interpretation of it. This may be the first time you've heard it. But first, let's get this caller, after which point we'll talk about whether the campground was underwater, which it was not. And you know that because you were out there. You walked around on Saturday. Here's a call, however. Let's see what that caller has to say.
Hi, you're on Free Radio Santa Cruz.
Hi, Robert. Hi, Mr. Mayor.
Mike is fine.
I would like to know, what do you plan to do when campers start trying to find some place to sleep? Are they going to be charged with these camping tickets, and is there going to be a problem with that? Is there going to be any time at all, or are they just going to start getting these $100, $160 tickets for not being in a legal place at night?
Okay, should I respond now? Go ahead. The campers on January 1st will be asked, their 14 days, which are the maximum anybody can stay in a state park, will be up. They understand that they only have till January 1st. That's what they had requested. They'll be expected to leave. From my talking with campers, I have a sense, and I may have these numbers wrong, that of the 42 people that were out there the day that I went out earlier this week, about 20 of them are planning to move on to other parts of the state, perhaps Southern California. 10 of them will probably go inside to the indoor shelter who are able to do so. And the remaining 10 to 12 people and probably do what they've done in past winters, which is find some place to camp out in the Poconip, under bridges, as Robert said earlier, other places where they are illegal for the camping that they're doing. The city of Santa Cruz has a enforcement on complaint policy basically around camping, so if other people see them camping, they'll turn them in, the police will come and arrest them, or cite them initially, first ask them to move on. If they don't move on, cite them, and then if they get enough of these citations, I guess eventually they end up in court. So basically they will have the exact same situation they've had in past years, and of course the situation they have anywhere else in the country, which is generally it's not legal to camp outdoors in most cities in the United States. I don't know of one where it is, and they'll face the same difficult problem that they faced in past years, and the city has no solution for them. I don't have to create some illusion about that. We do have indoor shelters with plenty of space for all the people that want to go inside. We do have transitional programs for people who want to get into drug programs. We have mental health programs. The people who are just looking for a shelter where they don't have to make any commitment to any kind of a particular program, but just looking for some place to stay dry, do have a place to go indoors. Finally, the issue of the people with dogs, we particularly don't have a solution for their problem. There's at least two of the campers that have had their dogs for a long time. I think everybody's sympathetic to these folks who don't want to give up their pets. Many of the people with dogs got those dogs in a very recent period of time. But I think the reality is we don't have easy solutions. There are some people in Santa Cruz who have made clear that they would help kennel these dogs for the winter, but that's not a long-term solution for the people's problem. They're going to obviously have to get their lives together in some way to be able to support a pet or find some place where they can go. And there's lots of even apartments in Santa Cruz where you're not allowed to have a pet. So, no, we don't have a solution for them. I wish the country had a solution to homelessness. We don't have one, and I don't know what to say, you know, other than the city is not going to be solving their problem.
A quick response, Mike, because we have another call coming in. Miami has been federally mandated to allow people to camp and live in public, by the way. That's one city if you're interested in knowing. So is Santa Ana, even though that decision was overturned by the California Supreme Court. They are, in fact, tolerating it because of circumstances down there. There's not plenty of space in the armory. If you talk to Paul Marceau, you'll hear there are 150 spaces in the armory at most and 56 spaces in the church program. That's a reality. There are 800 to 1,500 people in Santa Cruz City, and by my estimate, that are homeless. You include people from the hills hiding in the Poconip and so forth.
Let's clarify one thing about that real quickly, is there's space in the shelter, and nobody has been or will be turned away. What you're saying is there are lots more homeless people than the shelters could take if everybody were to decide to go into them.
That's right.
No argument. Stipulate that completely.
Right.
But nobody is outside right now who would like to be inside a shelter is being kept away from doing so. Would you stipulate to that?
No, there are people who are drunk who can't get into shelters who are outside in the rain, and I've seen them there. There are people that, and also there are people who can't go into shelter for different reasons who are outside because of job conditions, people who are in couples who can't go in. You're making a... I think the impression you're giving that everything's being taken care of is...
I don't have the impression that everything's taken care of, but the representation that there's like people that have no place that they can go. The jobs folks, we've changed the rules, so now people who have jobs can get into the shelters as late as 9 o'clock at night.
There's a 9 o'clock bus pickup at midnight.
Yeah, which takes people to shelters.
Right, but you can't get up there on your own. You have to be specifically at that spot.
That's the way people have decided to run these shelters, so they don't get so much anger from the people around the shelters that they end up being forced to close them down. I mean, that's a management issue. But people can go to a shelter as late as 9 o'clock at night, and so jobs are not a reason to not be in the shelter.
Caller, you're on the air with Mike Rapkin and Bathroom Spear Robert here.
Hi. Yeah, I just heard the responses.
This is Carl again, I understand, I take it?
Yes.
Go ahead, Carl.
I wonder how much a study has been done on the Vietnam vets who don't fit into any mental health program because this county doesn't accept post-traumatic stress syndrome as a symptom. And it doesn't seem that they can just normally fit into any particular indoor place, that outdoors is a good place for them. Yet, would they be given the same kind of treatment once, has there been any federal or state money allocated for this kind of problem?
Mike?
Well, I'm probably not the best person to ask what exact programs exist, but a lot of the Vietnam vets don't want to be in an indoor shelter and made that real clear. That's some of the people who are out there at New Brighton State Beach right now, and many of them have for many years, I mean, since 1975 or whenever they got out of the Army or the Marines or whatever, have been out camping out in places all over the place, and that's what they've done in past years. I don't believe there are adequate programs. I think the country totally abandoned and let down the people that, whether they had traumatic stress syndrome or just for whatever reason, basically never got readjusted to mainstream American life, which is, you know, understandable. The society basically abandoned those folks. But the issue is whether the city of Santa Cruz, a small town, is going to like solve that problem that's not being dealt with at the national level. And I don't think we have those kinds of resources. We do make a serious attempt to try and provide people, and the local Veterans Post and others do try and handle people on an individual basis and try and provide them with resources and so forth, but I would be lying if I said that somehow we have a solution to their problem. I don't think we do. I think our country has totally screwed them over and abandoned them.
Now, what if there was a private person who had land who wished to help these people? I understand that it's illegal to have camping on your own land.
Now, if people camp in somebody's backyard, nobody's going to know about it or cause a problem. I don't think, people will hang that stuff up on the technicalities, but if people have some piece of property where you're going to have somebody camp in your backyard, I don't think they're going to run into problems with anybody. If they become problematic and noisy and keep all the neighbors up, then like anybody else, there's noise ordinances and laws people have to deal with. But the representation that somehow somebody who wanted to be generous with their private situation would somehow be stopped, I don't think we have any cases of that, actually, in
Mike, would you facilitate then if somebody came forward with a piece of property and said, okay, I'd like to set up an open-air shelter here, would you be interested in facilitating that for the week?
No, it seems to me, that what I would suggest, if somebody wanted to set up a place for one or two people to camp in their yard, I would suggest they don't bring it to anybody's attention, just do it and nobody will bother them.
If
you're talking about setting up some, large campground that, again, will become an attractor, quickly become filled with large numbers of people and have an impact on the people around them, then I think we'd have to look at the particular proposal and figure out whether it was a rational one and whether we could operate it in some way that made some sense. It takes an actual proposal to figure out whether it makes sense.
You sound so reasonable. You always sounded that way. I have to say, line of patter, which is so reasonable, but again, ignores the basic issues that the city did wink at this matter. There wasn't raw sewage all over. There was one damaged porta potty, which the Citizens Committee for the Homeless had not repaired for 2 months, and which they gleefully showed the media as a great excuse to close down the campground in violation of the agreement. I mean, they could have sat down with the campers and talked about the situation as they'd promised. Let me play you the actual agreement. The words of, I believe it's Daryl Darling, of what the campground agreement was between SOS, Save Our Shelter, and the Citizens Committee for the Homeless, as represented by Paul Marceau and Daryl Darling. And here it is.
That was 5 years ago.
Oh! That was in 1990.
Really?
They talked about 91.
Yeah.
And
I
don't
know
what
it
was
here.
I think it's actually the other way.
Going to hold, but I think they will.
Here we are.
The board and conference
will
support
Garland's
what we're suggesting, which is what you just said.
And people can come to this first?
No, no.
People can come to this board meeting, Darrell, at 4 o'clock tomorrow if they'd like.
Sure. No sooner than January 1st, where we'll be moving. We'll review together as the weather unfolds. And beyond January 1st, no sooner than 10 days after permits are released. You have our word on that.
Yeah, you have our word on that. That enrages me, Mike.